Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Gennady Stolyarov II, and this is a bit of an experiment. You, I hope, will pardon the background noise in this recording, because I am currently performing my daily exercise on my elliptical trainer. I generally tend to run for about 50 minutes to an hour a day, and I thought I would try to use this as an opportunity to speak about topics related to indefinite life extension. I think it's a fitting combination, exercise and indefinite life extension, and if this works out well, I might designate this as a series of broadcasts. Running from death, that would be a fitting title, I think. So today, I wanted to talk about the prospects for the next several decades. What is the situation in which we find ourselves, and what are the factors that could contribute either to the achievement of indefinite life extension in our lifetimes, or the lack thereof? Now, many futurists have suggested that it's not a question of if human beings will extend their lifespans into centuries or even millennia. It's a question of when that will happen, when the technological sophistication to do that will come about. And I certainly agree with this. There is no inherent barrier in nature to the lengthening of human lifespans. Indeed, one can see this from other creatures that exhibit a spectrum of senescence. Certain kinds of tortoises senesce very slowly. Some do not at all. There is one organism, Turritopsis nutricula, that is functionally immortal. So it is possible both in nature and through technology as applied to human beings. But of course, the rate of technological progress isn't something that is assured in any society, in any era. We have seen numerous instances in human history where entire societies have regressed technologically. And after experiencing a spurt of development, innovation, accompanied by philosophical and moral progress, then reverted back to an earlier technological stage and a more savage moral stage. The best known example of this, of course, is what happened with the Roman Empire. Some, like the historian Edward Gibbon, allege that this was because of the adoption of Christianity by the Romans, and early Christianity, of course, scorned the desires of this world in favor of seeking a mystical afterlife. So as a result, the Romans turned away from technological pursuits, turned away from the enjoyment of worldly goods, and toward the so-called spiritual aspects. Now, this is one theory of what contributed to the decline of the Roman Empire and the technological quagmire known as the Dark Ages. It may well happen again. I'd like to point out that another theory of what caused the Roman Empire to decline has to do with an overarching hyper-interventionist government. There's no better law to reflect this than the Edict of Diocletian. Diocletian was a Roman emperor who lived in the late 3rd century, early 4th century. He passed an edict that makes Karl Marx and Vladimir Lenin look like Adam Smith and Ron Paul. This edict prohibited any individual from practicing a trade that his father didn't practice. It eliminated all mobility among ordinary Roman citizens. It imposed wage and price controls that were all-encompassing in scope. And of course, what happened with this kind of complete totalitarian control over the economy? Everything stagnated and everything began to fall apart. Within a century and a half, the Roman Empire was no more. So, could this happen today? Could government intervention at the federal level in the United States and at the national level in other countries become so onerous and so overbearing that it not only stops further technological progress, but reverses it as well? This is certainly an alarming possibility, and certainly we have seen in the United States over the course of successive administrations, especially with the Bush administration and the Obama administration, this degree of interventionism just skyrocketing. And unfortunately, medical progress has suffered as a result of this. There are good, well-established statistics showing that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved significantly fewer new drugs in the latter part of the first decade of the 21st century than it did during the 1990s and the first few years of the 2000s. This is just one example of how an added burden of top-down command and control imposition acquisitions slows down human innovation, makes it more expensive, deprives people of incentives to create, because it takes so much time and so much money to bring a new creation to market. And of course, if we're talking about indefinite life extension, there's not going to be one magic pill to achieve it. There are going to be numerous drugs and therapies and treatments that beat back some of the culprits of human mortality and senescence and death one by one. Some drugs might cure some cancers, or more effectively treat Alzheimer's disease. Those are just some examples of early victories that we could see. Other more revolutionary drugs and therapies might actually start to physically undo some of the damage due to senescence. But many observers have noticed that if the FDA continues to operate the way it does, with very few incentives for the FDA regulators to approve a promising treatment, and a lot of incentives for them to disapprove a treatment that has even a remote possibility of harming someone inadvertently, generating adverse publicity, and as a result, having a lot of flack thrown at the particular regulators who approved that drug or treatment. So, as a result, there is a kind of hyper-caution that actually costs hundreds of thousands of lives. The lives of people who don't get the benefit of new treatments that could have otherwise come out to market sooner. Also, the lives of people who perish because the rate of medical progress isn't as fast as it could have been. Just as with compound interest, if the rate of interest is 3% rather than 2%, it might make a small difference initially, but it makes a gargantuan difference over time. The difference between one's money doubling in 72 years under 2% interest and 24 years under 3% interest. It's huge. So progress is also a phenomenon like compound interest that builds on itself. New technologies, new treatments spur on other technologies and other treatments. Every advance is a building block for future advances. So what happens when one advance gets slowed down? It's not just that particular discovery that takes a few more years to reach the public, it's every subsequent discovery built upon it. So the effect is cumulative. Indeed, the combined delays of the Food and Drug Administration may have already set back the level of medical progress in the United States by decades, if not more. Where would we have been if the Food and Drug Administration had never had the oversight and approval power that it obtained in the first decade of the 20th century, now over 100 years ago? So with that in mind, of course, technology is still improving. It's a question of what the rate is. And I would submit to you that there's another side to this issue. This side is, what are the effects of technological change and technological improvement on human motivations, human decisions, and human ways of thinking? Perhaps the great tragedy of our era and of all previous eras in history, certainly eras like the late Roman Empire, which resulted in the undoing of a great civilization and the retrogression and stagnation of human civilization for over 1,000 years. What motivates human beings to make the decisions they do? I've increasingly come to realize that really only a small subset of the human population is intelligent enough, sophisticated enough, and benevolent enough, all three of these in combination, to come up with ideas that actually further human flourishing. I would say benevolence is actually among the most abundant qualities of these three. That is to say that most human beings genuinely want to do good. There are some exceptions to that, a minority of people, I would say, but most human beings honestly believe that the actions they advocate will bring about positive results. The problem is what Frédéric Bastiat called what is seen and what is unseen, the primary consequences of a policy as opposed to the indirect or secondary consequences. Most human beings are not very good at discerning the indirect or secondary consequences of a particular choice. This is why so many favor wage and price controls, or government printing of money, or various schemes for the redistribution of wealth, which definitely have obvious visible benefits for concentrated groups of people. Now, as a result of all of these schemes, the secondary consequences accumulate and produce a situation in a society that virtually nobody wants. Great case in point is virtually any Western and non-Western country today, where practically anybody from any political orientation is going to say, no, this society is not in line with my ideals, it's not what I wanted, it doesn't work well at all. Just ask any ordinary citizen in the United States or in Zimbabwe or in China. Is this society the society that you believe best reflects your values and your aspirations? But on the other hand, most of these people are also going to support some of the policies that make that society as problematic as it is. So with that having been stated, what is lacking in most people is the intelligence and sophistication to see through a bad policy. And as long as those qualities are lacking, the bad policies will continue to be promulgated and they will continue to retard progress. It doesn't matter what party gets elected into office, as long as the general population has the attitudes that it does and the ways of thinking that it does, these bad ideas will come to the forefront. And the politicians might have different flavors about them depending on the party they come from, but nonetheless, they will generally reflect one kind of absurdity or another. In the United States, for the Democrats, it's this overbearing redistributionist welfare state. For the Republicans, at least those who follow certain segments of their base, it's theocracy, militarism, corporate fascism, and of course the Democrats dabble in those too, to a certain extent. But in order to have a truly enlightened society that adheres to enlightened policies, I would suggest it's necessary for the distribution of intelligence and sophistication to change. There are a few people, and there have been pretty much in every generation, in every society, that have a more realistic and more sophisticated view of what good policies would look like, and they would be aware of secondary consequences. So many great philosophers, economists, and even the occasional politician or two have been minds of this sort, and I would add to that, of course, scientists, activists, various other innovators that have essentially been the sole contributors to progress over all of human history. Really, it can be said that a handful of individuals generated the main ideas, the prime movers of human societies, the ideas that made possible, for instance, the Age of Enlightenment, classical physics, the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution, the green revolution of biotechnology, and its effect on agricultural yields. Just a small handful of people, really, compared to the entire human species, contributed to that. But what would happen if pretty much the entire human species became endowed with these same abilities? And I'm not talking about anything superhuman. I am just referring to a level that is known to have existed throughout history and have characterized the best minds. I would argue the biologies of different human beings aren't that far apart. If Galileo or Shakespeare or Newton could accomplish great things, so could any other human being, really, with maybe a few tweaks here and there. Now, these tweaks that I'm talking about would not be possible without technology. And I'm not a genetic determinist. I don't believe that genes determine intelligence very much, or determine behavior. I believe that there is an immense element of free will and choice, and many courses of action and pursuits are open to human beings, including the pursuit of self-improvement. And I'm certainly no proponent of eugenics, or any kind of collectivized, top-down engineering of people. Once again, if human beings have choice and free will, they are autonomous agents, and their autonomy needs to be respected. But what if there were some way for human beings to choose, through technology, to enhance their minds, enhance their ability to think, and analyze, and learn, and refer to information, and recognize the secondary consequences of bad decisions? Now, of course, if such a technological advance became widespread, then more people would make increasingly better decisions, which would lead to a more fertile climate for progress, which means even more people have access to technologies that enhance their abilities to think rationally and productively, and as a result, even more progress gets made. And as you can see, this is a self-reinforcing cycle. It builds on itself in a good way. So the key question is, when will such technologies begin to emerge? When will they start to be available to otherwise ordinary people and shape the way they look at the world? And it could be an idea as, say, an artificial addition to the brain. If it ever becomes possible, and I definitely think this is feasible in the future, to add an electronic component to one's brain, give it the enormous processing and data storage capacity of a computer, so that one has a human brain with all of its tremendous assets alongside the assets of a computer, the ability to solve millions of problems simultaneously, that each would take a human being minutes or hours, the ability to store as much information as goes into an encyclopedia, and even more, the ability to genuinely recall the lessons of history. It's no longer that, well, you have to look up all of the societies that have declined because of a particular bad policy, and someone has to write a research paper about it. And maybe if that researcher is fortunate, 10,000 people will read the paper and extract something useful from it. What about the rest of them? They might, under today's state of affairs, never come across that paper and never learn those lessons. So every human being would be far more empowered to make better decisions. And it's not just the raw intelligence that I'm talking about here. Not just the ability to make these connections and have this huge brain power available. It's also the sophistication, something that has to be built up over time through considering an issue, through analyzing it in all of its facets and implications. That's not something that comes naturally or automatically to people. It has to be worked on. But what if it becomes easier to work on it? What if it becomes easier to learn? Just as one can download data to a computer practically instantaneously for huge amounts of data, what if one could download that kind of information onto a human brain? That would certainly speed up the learning process. No more need to go through all those years of schooling. So with that being established, I think fewer people would advocate bad policies. And as a result, the legal climate, the regulatory climate, the economic climate would all improve, and newer inventions would become available, eventually leading to a situation where human beings have figured out how to repair all of the major causes of damage to the human organism, effectively facilitating indefinite life. When will this come about? I certainly hope that within my lifetime and the lifetimes of the listeners of this broadcast, this will be a reality. But of course, history has no necessary laws governing it. History as a product of human choice and free will is contingent on human decisions. And I like to characterize our era as a race between competing forces. One of these forces is, of course, technological progress and human creativity and inventiveness, a drive that I think exists in that best segment of the human population, wherever those people may originally come from, and they come from all backgrounds, all areas of the world, all manners of experience. That drive is pretty much insatiable. In every generation, there will be people who want to tinker with the established way of doing things, who will want to improve upon it, who will want to invent completely new approaches toward problems, or means of facilitating human enjoyment. These are the heroes of the human species, and we definitely have plenty of them in our society today, relative handful compared to most human beings, but probably in absolute terms, a much larger number than at any other point in time, simply because the world's population is so much larger. Now, the other force, a much more sinister force, I would say, is the desire for violence and exploitation of human beings. The desire to achieve not by producing, but by taking what others have produced. And at the same time, this desire is coupled with an almost fanatical attachment to existing hierarchies and existing ways of doing things. A kind of anti-progressive mentality. And of course, by progressive, I imply no association with left-wing political thought of any stripe. I find that thought to be quite anti-progressive, in fact. So that other force, I will call it more generally the force of command and control, because I think that sums it up. The people who advocate it want to centralize all areas of human life under the umbrella of a single established way of doing things, allowing no room for variation in individual expression, for experimentation, for breaking from convention. And of course, there are different degrees to which different proponents of this mentality would take it. Not everybody who advocates a certain top-down intervention is a totalitarian, but what I'm positing is there is this general push in that direction. And it's certainly a push that's evident in the United States today. Virtually every policy of the Obama administration reflects it, as did most policies of the Bush administration before it. It is a nonpartisan movement. And of course, the movement for progress is likewise a nonpartisan movement. And really, what matters for that movement is not so much any political party affiliation, it's the desire to genuinely improve the world through peaceful and productive means by adding value to one's own life and the lives of the people with whom one interacts. So these two forces are at diametrical opposites. And the more centralization, regimentation there is in a society, the more impediments are placed in the way of ordinary people who try to elevate themselves to a more preferable social or economic position, who try to invent something, to start their own business, whatever it may be, the more obstacles exist to that, the slower the rate of progress is, and the more remote in time will be the emergence of these amazing life-saving technologies that I have spoken of. Now, in regard to the race between these forces, there has been a huge increase in top-down control in the Western world since the start of the most recent and ongoing economic crisis. But that's not to say that the movement for progress has nothing by which to recommend itself. It has, of course, one extremely powerful weapon, the Internet. The Internet, as I explain in my essay, Liberation by Internet, How Technology Destroys Tyranny, is an amazing tool of empowering individuals. It is a decentralized medium of communication, where there are practically no gatekeepers of information, where people can find information that actually interests them and concerns them and is of relevance to their needs. It's very difficult to usurp the internet as a centralized propaganda source. It is also very difficult, though many governments, say in China, Pakistan, Iran, have certainly tried to snuff out the internet altogether, to prevent people from learning, developing, innovating on its pages. So the internet, of course, has been a great breeding ground for future advances. We're seeing the beginning of that now with open source software. We're seeing it, of course, with the ability to purchase merchandise from anywhere in the world to enjoy a much wider array of choices than anyone would have envisioned prior to the age of the internet. We're seeing it with republication of information by such innovative means as the Creative Commons license or the GNU Free Documentation license, which bypass traditional, restrictive, all-rights-reserved models of copyright. And we're seeing it with BitTorrent technology, most of which, I would say, is used legitimately to share files that creators have rendered publicly available and are often used in development of open-source software. And, of course, by legitimately, I mean in accord with existing laws. I would say that all laws against file sharing should be repealed, but that's a topic for another discussion. So the internet may well serve as that crucial opening for other technologies to develop. And these could be technologies in entirely unanticipated fields. Already, art, music, writing, production of videos, journalism, for instance, through WikiLeaks, have been revolutionized by the presence of the internet, and really to the tremendous empowerment of the ordinary individual, not just allowing ordinary people to express themselves without having to ingratiate themselves with powerful elites, but also empowerment in the sense of the elevation of the person as such. I talked about technologies that enhance human mental capacity, and one of these enhancements is access to information. With access to information being improved by the internet, there's been some enhancement there, not as much as having that access integrated into one's brain, but it's a step forward. Also, of course, the ability to create so much more readily using the variety of technologies freely available through the internet has empowered human beings by literally making them more powerful, more influential, more productive. That's a trend that I hope will continue and become more palpable as time moves on. On the other hand, many governments in the world have caught on to this and see it as a problem. Look up the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, or ACTA, and read my essay on the subject, ACTA, The War on Progress, Freedom, and Human Civilization. And you will see exactly what these top-down institutions are doing, negotiating a treaty in secret that would dramatically curtail freedom on the internet. So these two forces are being arrayed against each other, and the parties on each side are becoming increasingly conscious of it. So the great struggle of our era is a struggle that underlies pretty much every societal change that we observe, and the resistance to that change. It's the struggle of progress, innovation, individualistic creation against command and control. And the outcome of that struggle is going to determine whether we get indefinite life extension within our lifetimes, before we die of senescence. So as you can see, the stakes are very high. And this is why I'm here, running from death and exploring where we are at in history and how we can get out of barbarism. The French Enlightenment philosophers in the 18th century like to write about the human race rising out of barbarism, out of the savagery, bigotry, and persecution that had characterized most of human history before them and had stopped virtually all progress in its tracks. And I would say these great thinkers, Voltaire, Montesquieu, Diderot, D'Alembert, so many others in the United States, Franklin and Jefferson, Great Britain, Locke, set the intellectual groundwork for the Industrial Revolution and subsequent tremendous improvements in the human standard of living. But if you think about it, we are still in the age of barbarism. We still cannot solve the essential questions that I would say any reasonable human being needs to know the solution to foremost. I pose two of these essential questions. One, how do we prevent our bodies, our own individual organisms, from lapsing into decay and death? And the second question is its analog for society. How do we prevent entire societies from losing freedom and prosperity and lapsing into command and control tyranny on one hand and chaos and disorder on the other? Those two are often two sides of the same coin. They alternate with one another. They accompany one another. A totalitarian dictatorship often presides over a society of what Ludwig von Mises, the great Austrian economist, called planned chaos. So how do we solve these two essential questions? How do we prevent our bodies from lapsing into death and decay? And how do we prevent our societies from lapsing into chaos or command and control tyranny? I would say those two are equivalent to death for a society. Well, those are the huge questions that have not yet been answered. I hope that with technologies that amplify human intelligence and sophistication, or opportunities for sophistication, we will get to some answers. And then we will rise out of the age of barbarism, and the real substantive advancement of the human race, of which we have only seen a prelude, will begin. And I certainly hope to be alive to celebrate that time, and to witness it as it unfolds new possibilities before us that we right now, in the infancy of the human species, may not have yet even conceived of.